So my name is Veronica Sanz. I come from the UK, from the University of Sussex in the south of England. Nice, sunny, not as sunny as here, I must say. And first thing I would like to ask you, how many of you are experimentalists? Still the same? Very few. I was hoping for more. It's always nice when experimentalists are taught more theoretical stuff, but that's really good that you're here. You too. Great. And also, I guess you already get the sense that I'm not a very strict person, and you can ask me any questions at any time, really. There are no stupid questions. There aren't. I'm sure that the things that I say that are not clear, they will be unclear for other people too. So you are making a service by asking the questions. So please do ask questions. It will make everything easier. I don't have like a very determined set of things I want to tell you. I have a plan, but I can also drop some of the things if you are really keen on understanding some aspects of what I'm saying. Okay. Also, my lectures are going to be all Blackboard, except I wanted to show you a couple of slides before we started. Okay, since most of you are theorists, cosmologists, maybe you feel the same kind of dread that I used to feel when you see these experimental slides, right? With lots of numbers and I'm sure you understand some of it, so you know that those are measurements done at the Large Hadron Collider. They are measurements of specific processes. So for example, the production of two massive gauge bosons, or the production of a gauge boson with top quarks, and so on and so forth. Or for example, here are ways in which we are producing the Higgs, okay? And what these numbers are is essentially the probability of this happening. And so when you go to smaller to larger numbers, you are talking about things that are very easy to produce or very difficult to produce, rare processes. And the error bars, the different error bars, correspond to different experiments. Oh, well, in this case, it's all CMA. No, ALDAS. Sorry, ALDAS. And different data sets, how energetic it was. For example, the LHC at 7 TeV, 8 TeV, 13 TeV, and thus the error bars they are assigning to the experimental measurement. And of course, it's a bit cheating because it's all this in a logarithmic scale, so you don't get the real sense and linear sense of what the error bars are, but you also get, for example, what are the theoretical predictions with their own error bars as well. Okay, so you see what this is telling you is that lots of things are being measured. Those things that are being measured are expectations of the standard model of particle physics, of the framework, the best framework and understanding we have of particle physics, and that's the standard model. This is essentially what nature is telling us, the experimental measurements, and this is what we expected, the gray bars, in the context of the standard model. And we are testing the standard model by comparing our expectations versus the measurements in a range of from very abundant to very, very rare processes. And everywhere, there seems to be a very good agreement. An easier way of seeing this is simply take the ratio between what we see, data, and what we expect, theory. And when everything lines up on one, that's good news for the standard model, bad news for us. But okay, I should say that I'm going to I should disclose I'm not a standard model theorist. Let's say I don't do precision calculations in the standard model. I am a beyond the standard model person. So I'm going to be teaching the standard model from the perspective of somebody who wants to break it, okay? That's why you will see the way I say things is, oh, unfortunately, everything agrees. Okay, fine. So we are testing the standard model. We are getting to higher and higher precision in the very abundant or very simple processes, but also we are getting to be able to produce the standard model in very rare processes. For example, these ones over here, where you have TT bar, and this top then radiates a gauge boson, and so on and so forth. So we are really looking at every corner and trying to find something that deviates from the standard model expectation. We are here to try to understand what makes the standard model so successful and how to break it, and how do we look and break it. Okay, so that's for many, many processes. In particular, something that we are especially excited about, if you want from the BSM perspective, are the Higgs. And I will tell you about the Higgs a lot in this course, and also the top. Those are massive particles. They fill whatever is going on in terms of the origin of mass in the standard model. And there are also places where we will expect that something unusual happens. And that's why from all these processes, for example, things up there with, that had to do with simple electroweak or QCD and so on, we are actually more interested in things that involve the top and the Higgs when it comes to the beyond the standard model. I can also show you what is the status of the Higgs, because here the Higgs is kind of summarized. All the measurements that we are making of the Higgs particle and its properties are summarized in these three dots. But actually, there's a lot more information that we can look at the Higgs. Many ways in which the Higgs is produced and it decays. All these are ways in which we are observing the Higgs and we are studying their properties. Again, a similar kind of plot. Again, being a theorist, I'm sure you don't find this very, very beautiful, but it's the statement that if you take what you see versus what you expected in the standard model, everything is more or less lying down on one. But notice that the error bars are quite big. The reason is that the Higgs production and the decays, the different decays, are still rare processes. It's like a newcomer. We just discovered it in 2012, and we are now being able to observe different characteristics. So it's only now, for example, that we are able to see the Higgs coupling directly to the top. That happened, let's say, a month ago, the discovery of that TTH. Or... Good question. It's one sigma, so I said the error bars are over here. So for example, 0.37 seems to be one sigma. Good question. So for example, the observation of the Higgs coupling directly to the top, that was announced in LHCp like a month ago. The Higgs into tau leptons, that is still something that is happening right now, and we still don't have a proper measurement of the Higgs to be bivar. Just to say that from all the processes that we think of from the standard model, it is those associated with top properties and those associated with the Higgs that are still, let's say, where there is hope of surprises, but also good reasons to hope for surprises. So I'm going to stop now with Telly. You had enough television now. So we are going to then start the proper lecture. As I told you, I'm a BSM physicist. Oh, it's cool. Who does this thing of the lights? So. No, the lights are great. It's somebody did it. It's cool. Thank you, God. Okay, so I'm going to be doing the standard model from a BSM perspective. Let's not hide the fact that I'm going to be teaching you about the standard model with the idea, with the hope, that by the end of these 6 hours you spend with me, you have a better and clearer idea of this structure, the complicated structure that the standard model has, and how this structure is part of you want this immense success with India there. OK, so let me maybe step back a second. I show you the summary plots. Everything seems to be perfect with the standard model when it comes to LHC measurements, LHC measurements. But as you know, although the standard model is a huge success, a paradigm that is led to incredible precision that we are seeing over there, you know, that is not the last thing, right? For example, the standard model can't explain a bunch of hardcore evidence things. For example, it can't explain what we know is there, and it's the dark universe, dark matter, dark energy. This is not incorporated in the standard model. Also, it can explain why there is hydrogen and not anti-hydrogen. Why is the universe filled with matter and not antimatter, or very little of it? And this asymmetry is something that it can't be explained in the standard model. And you know, also as you, we will discuss as well, the issue of neutrinos having masses is something that can be incorporated in the standard model. So it's a big chunk of things, right? It's about three quarters of, well, most of the universe, and the fact that the universe is made of matter and not antimatter, and the fact, you know, that there is a part of the standard model masses, the case of neutrinos, that can't be incorporated in the standard model. And that's something that this beautiful, successful paradigm cannot explain. Now it can't, so that's the big hardcore evidence, experimental evidence of beyond the standard model. Yes?
Sorry, what is the problem with the neutrino masses?
The problem with neutrino masses, and we will get there, I will show you the Lagrangian, is that the same way that you give the Higgs will give masses to everybody else, for example, it gives to the top, to the electron, and so on and so forth, we don't have an equivalent mechanism to give masses to neutrinos, that's all. And as we will see, that could be solved by asking for new physics beyond the standard model, and this new physics could be, for example, new neutrinos called sterile neutrinos, and then using them to give masses from the Higgs to neutrinos. We will go over this, but yeah. Very good questions. Any more questions? Yes?
I mean, this might be part of what I do, but the big one I'm aware of is gravity, and is that a different kind of chemistry?
Getting there, yes, exactly. Exactly. Ahe was saying, this is what we observe. I show you a lot of observations, measurements, sorry, in the Large Hadron Collider. They all agree with the standard model. Those are also measurements that do not agree with the standard model. They just don't happen in the Large Hadron Collider. The Large Hadron Collider is a position machine to test the standard model, and it's doing very well. Now, apart from this kind of measurements, there are other things where the standard model is unsuccessful. And I wouldn't say that are on the same level as these three pieces of evidence, but there are other reasons why we think that they must be beyond the standard model physics. And one is when the standard model kind of smells rotten. It's not that you've seen it decaying, or it's not that you've seen it doing something bad or not being able to solve a problem, it's just that you get the good hint that the standard model is failing somewhere else, and one of them is, tell me what did I do with energies above M Planck. That's something that the standard model cannot deal with, or is not made to deal with. Whether that theory about the Planck scale or around the Planck scale is quantum gravity or God knows what, or not God, but a scientist knows what. Certainly the standard model is not incorporating it. So effects of quantum gravity or something else are not there. Other things, all the structure, for example, how do we make sense of a quantum scalar? That's also something that the standard model can do, but that's the smell rotten, and we get to that in a second. So it has to do with the Higgs. It has to do with how a quantum theory of a scalar behaves, and how we have good reasons to believe that it's probably something else, something beyond the standard model, to make the Higgs a consistent quantum theory. But we can't say for certain that that's the case. Okay? So that's why it's smelling, but it's not really, we are not certain. Other things that don't make a lot of sense is, for example, the way how in the standard model, we get a lot of parameters. And those parameters are not, they are certainly ad hoc. Many of those parameters just come from, I write them down, is done. And also these parameters tend to be a bit separated from each other. So we have a lot of EU1, what is called hierarchies. For example, in the fermion masses. And the issue of a flavor in the standard model. Now is, again, I can write down those masses. I can deal with those masses at the quantum level and the fact that they are the value they are. But it just, there is something wrong about the way this is done. So it's not hardcore evidence, it's just an indication. Okay. So a lot of these problems with the standard models, either we don't understand the consistency of the quantum theory at some scale, or for some types of particles, in this case the scalars, or simply when we write down the standard model at their parameters, there are some parameters that are very different from others and we just don't understand why. And apart from that, you could start getting picky and talk about why three generations of fermions, why this and not that, what, is this the minimal thing, and so on. I think in general, when you think about the standard model and their success, one thing we can say for sure is that it is not simple. We are not talking here about the Occam's razor. We are not talking about let's put the minimal amount of structure to make everything work. Okay, maybe when it comes to the Higgs, it's very close to Occam's razor. But when it comes to the rest, in the standard model, there is a lot of structure, lots of it. So, and when I mean structure, I mean structure in terms of symmetries, whether exact, gauge, local, and so on and so forth. So lots of things that happen in the standard model that lead to the behavior we observe. And there is also a lot of, if you want, of matter content. That is certainly not the simplest option. Now, if you want, I don't know if you've seen these mugs or t-shirts that are all black with some white Lagrangian on them, right? Super famous. And you know, they are very cute. And we can also go to a non-physicist, let's say your family member or whatever, and give them this mug. And they think, oh, wow, you guys understand the universe with two lines of a Lagrangian. Yeah, sure, we do. Like, really, we love thinking that way because that's what we are aiming for, yes.
I just wonder if you think, oh, with these two boards of problems, those are like basically experimental, these are theoretical.
Exactly, that's the empirical evidence that the standard model is wrong. This is the rational why we think is wrong theoretically. Yes.
What about the recent B anomaly measurements? Are you going to speak about that?
Yes, I will tomorrow, if I leave. I'm trying to do the most the hottest topics, let's say. So today will be more a basic thing, and tomorrow it will be this, and I'll probably talk about the Higgs as well, because it's a big contender for possible new physics. Okay, so coming back to simplicity. It's true that we are aiming for it, we are striving for it, right? We want to find the minimal set of concepts, of principles, that then will explain all this complexity we are surrounded with. That's what we do, that's what we like doing, right? We don't like complex stuff, we don't like irrational behavior, and we don't like, things that are out of control. So we want to find the theory, and we want to find the simplest thing, and then the rest will just fall down from our theories. We want this top-down approach. And that's why when we write these things in this mug, let's say, with two lines, we feel pretty good about it. But we are not there. The standard model is not there. It's not as simple. And you know how we like, before we were using this kind of Lagrangian, we were also saying, oh, the standard model, let me show you. And then you will do SU3 cross SU2. Cross you one, that's it. I said it, that's the standard model. And then, you know, it is beautiful indeed. We will discuss about this and we will see how the gauge way, the gauge understanding of forces is an incredible breakthrough. Like, it's really conceptually a breakthrough, and that's why we are so proud of it. But it's certainly not simple. It isn't simple. So to make sense of all this data I show you, and the way it perfectly agrees with measurements, we need to get deep down into the structure of the standard model. So if anything, by the end of these 6 hours, I hope you will have at least gained some appreciation of what this structure is about. And then being able, hopefully you just don't do the standard model, being able to use these lessons, if you want, learned, into other theories, or theories that are maybe simpler, or theories that explain all this stuff that we don't understand.
You put gravity into the experimental or theoretical category?
Theoretical, okay. Because I had no clue. Yes. So what is the theory that completes the standard model about M. Planck? No clue. And it will be great to think about it. And many, many people are thinking about it, and especially here at Perimeter, we have excellent people doing that. Okay, and also, another thing I like to stress, and it's coming back to this issue of the hierarchies, is that in the standard model, and again, coming back to this image you have of the mag with the Lagrangian and two lines, you know, it's beautiful indeed. But every parameter there is very different from each other. We are certainly not talking.
Can I ask you a question? I've actually seen this mug. Can you write the Lagrangian you're referring to?
The Lagrangian of the standard model?
Yes, I have not seen it.
It's the shirt I wore yesterday.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Can you? One day earlier. Yes.
I'm a little surprised that you said you put gravity into theory. How, like, what do you make of the actual, like, you know, experiment part.
Let me clarify. I don't mean, let me clarify. I don't mean that the fact that we experience gravity and gravity is around is a theoretical issue. It is an experimental issue. Now, that observation doesn't tell us that the standard model is wrong. It's not a way of saying that the standard model is wrong, or it's not indicating so far where the standard model is going to fail in the Large Hadron Collider. So in that sense, those are the guys that are the empirical evidence that the standard model fails. And those are things that indicate that we need to complete the standard model. Certainly we need to do it here. And then other issues. Yeah, thank you, that's good. Okay, so coming back here, in this famous mug, and I hope you bring the t-shirt. All these beautiful terms, and every dimensionless and dimensionful term over there, they do vary a lot, especially when you take into account flavor and so on. So we are not talking about order one parameters when we will expect order one parameters. We are not talking often about our nice naive dimensional analysis. Have you heard about NDA? It's a very powerful tool, right? It's a way of showing off, if you want. It's like you can actually get rather accurate guesses if you understand NDA. Now, when we come to the standard model, often our NDA way of thinking will fail.
What did you say NDA stood for?
Naive dimensional analysis thing. And I want to mention this because often when we do beyond the standard model and we don't have any kind of other way of computing things, for example, when I'm thinking about a strongly coupled new theory, let's say a composite Higgs, I'm restricted to use things like naive dimensional analysis. And I will take this and then I will play with it and I will assume this is indeed the case. But when we come to the standard model, the reality we see, NDA is not always a good way of dealing with it. Okay, any more questions?
Not order, oh, I see, under naive, okay.
Mm-hmm. I was hoping for more experimentalists because then I could make my point. Yeah, you know, you see how we are advancing in terms of our experimental understanding. I mean, I'm talking about since 2012 to now, the understanding we have of the Higgs is amazing. We see the Higgs in so many ways, and we have very detailed kinematic information of how the Higgs is produced, it decays, testing the real Lorentz structure of the couplings, being able to actually testing things properly. And this is in a matter of years. We are talking about 6 years, right, since the discovery to the moment we are right now. And when it comes to electro weak processes or strong processes in the standard model, we are getting a precision that is, we are in the era of precision. We have the Large Hadron Collider, as you probably heard. A Hadron machine is a dirty machine. It's a machine done for discovery. It's not done for precision in principle, because just smashing protons and then hoping to understand something. But so many years of so much work from the experimentalist part that now we have this dirty hadronic machine became, or is becoming, a precision machine to test the standard model. So we are in this situation where we are pushing and pushing the precision boundaries. But again, the precision, only to get precision makes no sense. What we are doing, we are pressing the boundaries, we are pushing the balls, the walls until they break. That's what we want, right? So it's great to pursue this precision path, but we also need to take into account that the aim of this pursuit, if you want, is to break it. Now, when it comes to where are we going to, or could see discoveries, or could see things beyond the standard model, certainly the LHC is one place, and this place is now going in the route of precision, meaning that if we see something new at the Large Hadron Collider, it's probably going to be in a detailed fine-grained stuff already. But it's not the only place to look for new physics, as you can imagine. I'm not going to talk about dark matter or other things you will hear in other parts of this school, but you are going to learn about it as well. But there is also more precision machines or more precision measurements, like, as you probably know, the EDM, G-2 is also quite timely nowadays. All the issues of flavor that have been mentioned already is also the root of precision. And there we could find new physics by looking at deviations that are very tiny, and they don't agree with the standard model. But don't also just think that this is the only way to look for new physics. We also look for new physics in using ingenuity, if you want. As you know, apart from these big collaboration things, as is happening in the Large Hadron Collider, there is a lot of medium-sized or small experiments that are testing, if not the standard model directly, our understanding of particle physics in other ways. And those have the capacity, at least, of finding a new type of phenomena. I'm thinking, for example, satellites looking for axions, or, I don't know, ice cube. You will hear about this a lot as well. Those lead, or taking or small experiments that had been designed, for example, for the search of a specific type of new physics, and then actually they are then redirected to look for another type of new physics. Those are happening all the time. So the LHC is the big player, is the one that is showing the most capacity to search for precision and for testing the standard model, but it's not the only one. Ingenuity, and by that I mean small experiments. If you want the underdogs, nobody thought they will find something, they might also find something, and it's worth keeping an eye on them. Since most of you are theorists, then I'm not saying you should join one of these collaborations, but for example, what experiment are you on, or what experiment are you studying?
I'm not into an experiment, I'm just detector and hardware.
Ah, cool. That's awesome. So you're here, that's great. And you?
I'm in Zenon 110.
In what?
Zenon 110.
Ah, Zenon 110, awesome. Okay. So what about the rumors that you were going to show a 3 sigma? That's not true.
We looked
at archives. Yes, I did.
We showed it not to be true.
Yes, I know. Very good. Okay. So what we are going to do is to think about this standard model and think in terms of building blocks. So what are the things that we need or we use in the standard model to build it? Okay, so those building blocks are the same kind of theoretical building blocks you will use for beyond the standard model most of the time, unless you are very crazy, and please be crazy if you can. When you're a theorist, it's great if you go beyond this kind of pathway, but at least the building blocks we get from learning about the standard model is, of course, quantum field theory, and most of you have done a course on that, so that's great. And let me also say that those are building blocks for a successful standard model. And by successful, what I mean, I never know if it's two S's, I think so. What I mean is that it does agree with data. That's what successful means. And it doesn't mean that it's beautiful. Okay? I think we settled that down. It's not that it's successful for a theorist would have been to build a beautiful theory. The standard model is success. It's its agreement with what we see in nature. So what does the standard model do? Or how do we build the standard model to make it successful? So we rely on quantum field theory. That seemed to work very, very well. We also rely on the use of symmetries, many types of symmetries. And we are going to spend a lot of time today thinking about symmetries, on how to impose symmetries and how to break them in a consistent way. We will be interested in doing that. We also rely on luck, if you want. And by luck, I mean that we are able to do perturbation theory. So often our ability to build a successful, so a predictive standard model relies on the fact that, thank God, some of the parameters in this beautiful Lagrangian are small enough that we can do perturbation theory. Often when perturbation theory is not valid, then we rely again on symmetries and sometimes some understanding of dynamics, although this is quite restricted. Okay? And also part of quantum field theory, we also rely or we think about the standard model and the predictions of the standard model in things that I will call, if you want, end of the road. For example, the fact that we need to have a unitary theory. So that's a way of, for example, introducing the idea of the Higgs, is to restore unitarity of the WW scattering, but it's also an idea that you can apply to many other things. For example, if you think of a new sector of beyond the standard model, are strongly coupled, or for example, you are thinking about anything, including dark matter. This concept of unitarity and how to restore it becomes important. Okay. Any questions? Yes.
What exactly do you mean by dynamics in this context?
Dynamics, so.
You mean if, in like QCD, if it's strongly coupled?
For example, exactly. So for when you have a theory that it behaves in one way in a regime of energies, and then because of evolution with energy, you change completely the kind of theory you are talking about. What are your degrees of freedom and so on? So QCD is a good example where you go from quarks and gluons to other states, but also you could think on, for example, you look at the evolution of your couplings or the evolution of your potential, and then you see that you are reaching a different type of theory. So whether you are thinking of the beta function and approaching a kind of fixed point, or you are thinking of a scalar potential and you are looking at different vacua.
This is an example.
Okay, good. More questions? Okay, so We are going to spend some time talking about symmetries. Have you ever seen, or have you had a course on group theory? You don't have to, obviously. But no? Awesome. So at least I'll have something to say. That's always good. Group theory is the mathematical way we understand symmetries. So we are going to talk about that. So let's start with symmetries. Okay. So let's start with this famous SU3 cross SU2 cross U1. You've probably seen that before, and you know that this is the way we express the three forces that we know of in the standard model. SU3 of color, SU2 left, and cross U1, where the U1 is of hypercharge, and how the Higgs mechanism will lead to these two last ones, SU2 cross U1, to become U1 electromagnetism at low energies. So we are going to discuss this process. I'm going to explain to you how this Higgs mechanism happens, hopefully from another point of view of what you've already seen, if you have seen something. But to get to that point, what is this all means, we need to talk about symmetries, and we need to understand them a bit more mathematically. So let's do that. Okay, so there's the concept of symmetry. That's something that you've probably seen before, no? So what is your idea of symmetry? How would you define a symmetry? Anybody?
Find conserved quantity.
Okay.
Something which remains unchanged under a defined transformation.
So that would be the manifestation of a symmetry.
Yes.
Very good.
So that, like, including the simple geometric, like translational, rotational symmetries, as well as the Lyapunov ones, there's some transformation and something doesn't get changed by it.
Okay. So the physics remains the same. You had another same thing. Very good. So we are talking about invariants. We are talking about things that stay the same. Physics. Measurements that stay the same, although I'm doing some kind of transformation. And it's easier to think in terms of space-time symmetries or transformations that you do in real space and time. So you can think on rotations, you can think on taking pictures of something time after time, and you can see whether this is changing or not. You have this intuition built on. But as you know, a lot of the understanding that came in the standard model is precisely from the use also of internal symmetries. Those are not so intuitive to understand, but they all come and they form part of exactly the same thing. So my aim here is I'm going to talk a little bit about the standard model, the forces, and so on. Then I'm going to define what symmetries are as a group. Then we are going to start talking a bit more mathematically about symmetries. And all this is just to give you the idea that we can use exactly the same group, exactly the same concept of symmetry in completely different situations. Okay? So we are going to use exactly the same group or mathematical entity that will be able to help us understand things like the spin. Any spin, spin 0, spin 1, spin 1/2, spin 2, spin 3, I don't care. The same mathematical concept will be the one behind what you know already, which is rotations. Same mathematical concept will help us understanding the interactions of nucleons. And the same mathematical object is precisely this electroweak force over there. So completely different manifestations of exactly the same mathematical abstraction. So it's a long way until we get there, also meaning half an hour or so. In the meantime, we are going to start little by little learning about the standard model. So as you know, we have the standard model, some fundamental interactions. This SU3 cross SU2 cross U1 is manifestations or a way of representing the forces you know about already. So we know about electromagnetism. So that's the force that is experienced by anything with an electric charge. OK. We know about electromagnetism, that is a long-range force. And what it means is that it can be felt very far away. It just, as in the case of gravity, it will die off as 1 over r squared. But in principle, it's non-zero all the way to infinity. So that's electromagnetism. You also heard about the weak interaction. And that force is responsible, for nuclear radioactivity, for example. And one thing we know about this weak interaction is that it's not long range, it's short range, it's very short. And what this means is that we, particles that are charged under these weak interactions, do not feel the weak interactions all the way. It's only in a confined space, in a short range, where they feel it. Farther away, this interaction dies off very, very fast. So that's the weak interaction. And then we have the strong interaction. You know about that. This is the force responsible for the nucleons to stay together and for nuclei. It's important, you know, it's the prime object that leads to the formation of atoms. It's what we are made of. And it leads to an important thing, which is stability of the nucleus. It keeps these guys together. And then set apart, again, this guy is also short range, so it's only felt at a very small range. A bit larger or larger than the weak interactions, but still confined in a region of the size of the nucleus. And finally, there is the gravitational interaction. Okay. As you know, different from the electromagnetism is that gravity, as far as we know, is only an attractive force, whereas electromagnetism can be attractive or repulsive, depending on the charge of this guy. So we always see it as attractive. Although, again, coming back to whatever is up there at M Planck, this may be very different. So far, so good. We see that gravity is always possessing this attractive behavior. And it's also long range, the same as the electromagnetism. Electromagnetic force.
Would it be fair to say that another way of phrasing that gravity is always attractive thing is that there is only one gravitational charge, there's no opposite, there's no negative charge for gravity, so there's really no observe any other
things of that. Exactly. So for
multiple colors or multiple charges or whatever, it's just one.
So you think on the charge for gravity to be the mass,
yeah.
Although this, what I'm doing is borrowing the language of quantum field theory, and we don't have quantum field theory here, so I'm just borrowing. And if you think in those terms, and that's very sloppy, I will say, well, mass is always positive, it's always attracting. So you always get that sign. But it could be that we have objects out there, or maybe at high energies, we see a completely different behavior. We don't know. More questions?
So when you consider gravity, you only consider mass, but then you don't consider the energy momentum tensor, and maybe the violation of strong energy condition, and you have a repulsive force.
It could happen. All this, I don't know how you feel about this. You are young people, right? You want to make your mark and make your difference. Focusing on the things that everybody understands is not interesting. Those kind of, the things that are esoteric, weird, that are, what? Those are the things that are really good to think about. Okay, so yeah, I'm saying this because that's what we see so far. And it can be wrong. And this is the great thing about particle physics. We never get bored about it. Okay.
Would an opposite gravitational pressure be negative mass or imaginary mass? Sorry. I mean, of course, there is the thing that because positive pressure gravitates and negative pressure anti-gravitates, this dark energy seems to have negative energy. So when
exactly.
It anti-gravitates, and we have this exponential expansion in the universe. So it's sort of an exception, but it's not a negative force between particles. It's sort of this field gives this
creating more space.
Yeah.
Actually, yes, indeed, and it's a pity because it's so far away from the standard model. I won't be talking about dark energy. I hope somebody in this school will do. Are you talking about dark energy? No, but it is really a difficult subject, and to make sense of dark energy in the context of particle physics is very hard. So that's an interesting thing to think about. But indeed, it behaves as a negative pressure kind of substance. And we sometimes say that it creates a space, and that's why it's accelerating the universe. But you know, from this talking to actually making a successful model in particle physics of dark energy, we seem to be quite far away. But you know, maybe I'm not that. Good. All right, so now let's keep talking about symmetries, things we understand. Okay, so those forces that we are talking about, as you already know, everything is particles, including forces, and forces are nothing but, or understood if you want, as exchanges of mediators. You remember when you were undergrads and you were told, or even maybe in a level, high school, you were told, so if I have a charge Q and another charge Q prime, and I want to understand the force between them, I will think on a force that is goes along a straight line, along these two, and I think on this force has been repulsive and attractive, and then I do my calculations. And at some point, you move a step up, and then you started thinking about something a bit more abstract. And you started thinking on this second charge becoming a probe charge, and this being actually the charge you care about, and isolating it, forgetting about this, and thinking about this charge creating a field around it, right? So you started thinking about the potentials that are generated by this charge and how the potential of this charge can be then manifested in terms of a force as soon as I put a probe charge over here. Right? Remember all this? That was a long time ago, hopefully, and now you already know that at least at the quantum level, when we think about forces between particles, we go even farther. We took this potential here. We changed from the potential to a field. In this case, it was a photon. And then we thought, well, we think about this force experienced by charges as being quantum exchanges of these virtual particles, of these force mediators. And that was, you know, a lot of generalization, a lot of abstraction, going from the simple thing that you have two charges and they will attract or go away from each other, to think more mathematically, until you get to this concept of having a force mediator. So you know that the force mediator of electromagnetism is a photon, and that's a massless particle of spin one. You also know that the weak interaction, or you don't, and let me know, is mediated by what we call the W plus minus and the Z bosons. So three spin one particles whose mass is not zero. So the W mass has a mass of 80 GeVs, and this is 91 GeVs. So they are non-zero. And their mass then is associated with the range of the weak interactions. You probably saw all this at some point, right? Very good. You also know that the strong interactions become quite tricky as you are thinking about low energies, because we change the dynamics involving strong interactions are interesting and are non-trivial. But if you think about the strong interactions at high enough energies about confinement, then you can think on the mediator of this force as being yet another spin one particle, the gluon, massless, and as well spin one. And again, borrowing language from the standard model, we tend to think on gravity, if it ever gets promoted to the quantum field theory that these guys are, as being again a force that is mediated by a force mediator, and then in this case, it has to be a spin two particle, again massless, because it's long range, and then we think of it as being spin two particle as being a matrix of 4 by 4. So M equals U.
Sorry, you said massless because it is long range.
Exactly.
But the strong force is mediated by gluons, they're also massless and that's short range. So what's the connection between massless and long range?
Yes, here, what happens in the strong sector is that at high energies behaves very nicely. I can think of it as having this guy has no mass, spin one, my description is beautiful. But at some point, something non-trivial happens. As we go to lower energies, these dynamics I was talking about kicks in. And in particular, what it happens is that the strong interactions go from one regime to another regime. They say the quark-gluon idea, the quark-gluon plasma and so on, it goes to a completely different description that is instead based on mesons and baryons. You can think on also a part of these baryons, the nucleons. And the force experienced by nucleons, so protons, neutrons, is effectively, you can think on them as being exchanged by pions, and pions are not massless, they have a mass. But pions are not fundamental particles, and those are not fundamental interactions. So pions are made of bound states of quarks, and their mass comes from the binding strong interactions, and that makes it short range. Any more questions? Hopefully this is something that you've seen in some form, or and is clear enough. Okay, so here, just to reiterate, the fundamental force, strong interaction, has a part, quite a simple behavior, but its confinement at lower energies that makes this theory so bloody complicated, okay? And then it becomes short range and everything.
Is that because of the strong coupling?
It's because of the strong coupling, exactly. With a strong coupling, you can reach interesting non-trivial dynamics. Perturbativity and interesting things are kind of at odds with each other. So the strong sector is really nice in the sense that we can, by understanding the strong sector of QCD better, we might be able to draw lessons on how to build models for strong, new strongly coupled sectors. So this, for example, if you're working on composite Higgs models, or when I was young, we were working on technicolor models, what we will do is to listen and understand what QCD was doing, or what we knew about QCD, to try to translate into new theories. And there was a lot of dynamics involved, but also a lot of symmetries too. Any more questions? I guess, Cliff, are we supposed to have a straight 1.5 hours, or should I let them
appear to?
10:30? Okay. No, I'm fine. It's you that you might. So you can withstand another 30 minutes? Yeah? Think about the coffee. Very good. So after all this talking, let's get into symmetries. And what symmetries are going to do, you already mentioned, is things that look different, but when you look down at them and then you compute things, for example, a physical observable, they actually lead to the same things, to the same physical consequences. And these are the kinds of things we want to do. We want to find connections among phenomena that do not seem to be related to each other. Remember, our aim is always trying to find an underlying principle that is explaining all this different behavior that is happening. Symmetries are a very powerful tool of doing that, because symmetries precisely relate situations that seem to be completely unconnected, but actually they have the same underlying principle. Now, to think about symmetries, I also need to tell you about the use of the action principle, and the Lagrangians. You've all seen that, right? So you are okay with that? You know that everything comes from an action principle. That's also the way we used to quantize and to lead to quantum field theory. All these are known things. Then I can skip that. Okay. So these symmetries, then, will be nothing but transformations or invariants on the transformations, and then I will tell you of what and where. So it will be transformations of coordinates, it will be transformations of fields, it will be any kind of transformation you do that will lead the same kind of physics. So we are trying to find in our theories some kind of transformation I can make anywhere to my theory that leads to exactly the same result. Now, what is what I use if I want to compute anything, let's say a cross-section or a decay or any physical thing? What will I use as a starting object? So in particle physics, what do you use to compute?
Feynman diagrams,
very good. And where do these Feynman diagrams, the Feynman rules that you use for the Feynman diagrams, come from?
From a path integral and functional derivatives.
Well, sounds good. But this path integral is of what object?
Of the action.
Of the action. Okay? So your starting object is an action. Okay? So is my action that at which I have to impose those symmetries, so these transformations. Remember, the action depends on the coordinates of space-time, in principle, the calculation that leads to that, and depends on the fields on them. So I can look at this action, and I can think of possible ways in which I can make something to it and see whether the physics after those transformations stay the same. So I will do transformations of space-time coordinates, so the space-time symmetries, you want, or sorry, transformations. But I will also go and try to do things to the fields, so transform the fields, to do internal transformations, and see if by doing that I come up with something that after I transform, I actually end up with exactly the same action. Now, often the action by itself is I don't know you ever used an action unless you are a cosmologist, but in particle physics, you usually don't think about the action. You use what? Lagrangian. Very good. And that's nothing but some integral over space-time, of course, with some stuff that has to do with things that you care as a cosmologist, and a Lagrangian. So our idea is to try to find transformations that leave the action the same. So that will be finding a symmetry of the system. So what is the symmetry of S? But often, we actually look for symmetries in the Lagrangian. And we don't think about the action so much. The reason is that often in particle physics, we actually don't care that much about this part. This is an integral over space-time coordinates, and is also here taking into account the geometry of space-time. When we do a scattering experiment, let's say in the Large Hadron Collider, we are in a situation where we are talking about flat space-time and nothing too interesting is happening here. So we often translate from looking at symmetries here as actually looking at symmetries here because this part is kind of trivial. This is not always true. For example, even in the Large Hadron Collider, you might be thinking about theories in more than four dimensions. You might be thinking even on producing black holes at the Large Hadron Collider. You might be thinking about, again, theories that have some kind of boundary conditions in space, and then you care about that part. So you need to incorporate that. But most of the time, we just don't care about this, and we just think of symmetries of the Lagrangian. Okay? So symmetries is a way of finding an invariance. And in a way, it's also a pathway for unification. And here, unification has the meaning of I have lots of several sectors of behavior that look apparently different, but actually, when you look at the mathematical consistency, when you look at the way they behave, and you look at their Lagrangian, you see that although we are talking about, let's say, a different force, different particles, different everything, the mathematical abstraction of the symmetry behind is the same. And this will become important because you are actually unifying different types of phenomena. This is not the first time you saw unification in that sense, using symmetries. You've started probably the first year of your undergrad talking about special relativity, right? You were probably quite excited about Einstein and, you know, time dilation and all this. But this special relativity and the concept of special relativity and then general relativity comes from this kind of symmetry thinking. You remember that Einstein was talking about how all inertial reference systems are the same. That it cannot be that there is one preferential reference system. And he, well, not just him, also Galileo before him, but he thought that that was a principle in nature. That was a statement about asymmetry, is that this reference system might see something that is very different from that reference system, but actually they are the same. They are expressing the same physics. So when you go down into what kind of laws of physics those reference systems will see, they are the same. They measure different times, they measure different distances, different behavior, but the laws of physics, the differential things, the F equals MA is exactly the same. So here is the same. We are looking for those kind of symmetries, those kind of invariances, and see how far we can go. Okay? Let's see. Very good. Okay, so now I've been talking about transformations. So a symmetry will be to find an invariance under a transformation. And the symmetry transformation think of it as, let's say, just to put an example. Think of a state, a quantum state of an electron. And then you want to take this electron and do something to it. Let's say rotate it, change something about this system, and do a new state of electron that has been transformed. Let me call this transformation this process that will bring me from the initial electron to whatever is afterwards as this guy over here, U. So think on U, you probably already seen this kind of notation where this electron could be a kind of vector with two entries, and then U would be a matrix 2x2. So that's one possibility of a transformation. And then if after I do this, if after I've done this transformation, the physics stays the same, So I see the same behavior, and by that I mean the same laws of physics, the same differential quantities and so on, then I declare that this transformation I made is a symmetry of the system. Okay, now that's interesting information to have. Okay? Now, it's not like, as you can imagine, as a stamp collection. It's not like you go, you have your nice Lagrangian or your nice system, experimental system, and you want to go and play with it and see the same result. It's not just for fun. The reason why we look, search, and really try to find symmetries in everything we do, and even if there are no symmetries, we often theoretically imagine there are symmetries. So we go to extreme case where there is a symmetry and then try to bring this calculation to what we actually see. It's because symmetries, once you identify a symmetry, you have a very powerful tool to compute. You will end up being able to find conservation laws. It will give you predictions of how this system can then interact with other systems. What are the consistent ways in which this happens? It will also be able to tell you whether this system that has a particular set of symmetries can be maybe unified with other systems. Okay. I'm not sure that this is too vague at this stage, or you want a specific example. If you are happy with it, we continue and I show you examples later on. But as long as you believe that identifying a symmetry is actually quite powerful, then we can move on. Everybody is happy? Okay. Okay, so I'm going to just quickly tell you what a group is mathematically. And don't worry, you don't remember in 2 seconds. It's not that important. It's just a specific type of operation you want that you can do mathematically. So it is a group. A group is a set of elements. Plus some law of manipulating those elements. For example, you could think on a multiplication law. Multiplication. So essentially, is choose some elements. They can be as abstract as you want. And then a way of manipulating and relating these elements. And to these two things, to become a group in mathematics, they need to satisfy the following. They need to have a closure. It's not because somebody dies, it's just a closure. So what closure means is that you're thinking about two elements of this group. Let's call it them A and B that belong to that group. If A and B belong to the group, then the multiplication of these two, AB, also needs to belong to the group. So for all A and B, all elements of the group, this operation of relating those two needs to lead to another member of the group. That's closure. So you cannot use this law to take two elements away from the group. So there is a closed group. The second one is simply associativity. So because you are thinking about multiplication, you know what I mean by that. So A, B, let me just make sure. If you take not two, but three elements, then you take two of them, multiply them by the third, it has to be the same as any other combination. So that's for all A, B, and C in the group. Let me know if this is confusing, okay? I'm assuming that by intuition, at least with the operation of multiplication, you know what I'm doing. The third one is that this group contains the unit element. So the unit element, let me call it E, that belongs to the group, and the unit element is the one that, when multiplied by any element of the group, it leads back to that element of the group. Yes?
What's special about associativity? Why are distributive properties, or obviously commutative, but distributive is other than what I was saying. Why is that other power?
I guess if you think, for example, on rotations, that's a good intuition. It's, physically, you understand that if I have to go from this point to that point via rotations, whether I do it like a little bit, and then that, or I do like this, and then that, I should get to the same point, right? So the recursive use of this multiplication rule, which could be rotations of a given angle, needs to essentially lead to the same result. So it is just part of the definition of the group. It just happens that this associativity is something that we see in physics, in our application. But you could also have a different set that doesn't have this associativity.
Could you have a group that isn't distributive? Like you don't have a distributive property?
Like this one?
No, you have associative, but you don't have distributive. So you have like A plus B times C is not the same as A times C plus B times C.
There's no operation.
Okay. But the distributive doesn't come into it because you need two operations for that to count.
But it's true that, for example, groups are not necessarily commutative, right? So that's not necessarily the case. So it's not as general as possible, but associativity is key. And it comes back to this idea that the order in which we do an operation should not be that relevant, as long as the operation is done in the same order. Sorry, in the same sequence, A, B, C. A, B, C, A, B, C. Whether I decide to pair these two or these two should not be relevant. This is only true for what we will call abelian groups, and that's only a small subset of groups. And then, of course, it needs to have an inverse element. Which
do you have to be commutative in the sense that everything has to be a unit element?
So this has to be the same as E times A, that's correct.
Okay.
And the inverse is, let's call it A minus 1, and this has to satisfy this. OK, so that's not a lot of math, hopefully.
Is that from right inverse as well? Is that a requirement?
You mean that this is also true?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's also true. Very good. So it was A minus 1. Okay, so let me give you an example of a group. And the reason why I went through this writing down the definition of the group is that I want to show you something. What I want to show you is that, it is still time, that what you call A group can be represented, the representations of a group can be very, very different. And it's still the same group. So let's do a very, very simple example of a group, a discrete group, which is Z3. Have you ever heard about Z3? Or C3, in North America.
Yeah.
Oh, really? It's just because it's a very cute little example. It's easy enough that we can actually do stuff and show you the point that the same statement, that's my group of symmetry, those are the transformations I'm going to talk about, can be represented in many different ways. So this is a discrete symmetry. And what it means is that it goes from one element to the other, but it doesn't discrete as opposed to what we will do later on, which is a continuous symmetry, and a Lie algebra and so on. is a finite group. And what I mean by that is that the elements of this group are finite. It's just three of them. So let me call these elements A, B, and A, E. So I need to have the unit element here. Okay? So my group is going to be made of three elements, A, B, and E. And what I call Z3 is essentially going to be represented by, I take these elements, A, B, and E, A, B, and E, and I'm going to show you in a table how they talk to each other. What is the multiplication law that transforms from one element to the other? Now, the way you need to do this is like Sudoku, essentially, is you need to make sure that it agrees with all these four conditions over here. So as you can imagine, we are going to need one of the guys, A, to be the inverse of the other, and so on. So we end up with this multiplication table. So B, E, A, E, A, A, E, B, B. OK, if I haven't made a mistake. OK, cool. This is my group, and that's the way I define an operation in it that is consistent with the rules of a group. And by saying that this is my group G and this is the multiplication, I have actually defined my group. But that's one way of doing it. You could also think on exactly the same C3 as being actually the group that is spanned by finding the roots of an equation. So you've probably done this in your complex analysis. You've been asked, where are the roots of z one-third equals 1? So this is my equation that I need to solve, and where z is a complex number. And you've done this probably, right, and found that the solutions are the obvious z equals 1. And but I also have two other complex solutions that are distinct from each other.
Z cubed equal
1. Z cubed.
Polynomial equation. Instead of z to the
1/3. Yes, thank you. Thanks. And 4/3. And you probably have represented these solutions by looking at a complex plane of the real part of z and the imaginary part of z. And you looked at those solutions as being essentially the roots that are sitting over here. So it's a triangle. So you think on these guys as being A, B, and E, my elements. Essentially, all what I'm saying is that the rule I'm talking about is the rule of going from one to the other. So you have a geometric description of Z3, and it comes from actually solving an equation. But you could also choose a completely different representation of the same group. A, B, and E are just an abstraction, and this mathematical table is just a set of rules, but who represents A, B, and E is up to you. So for example, another representation of the three will be that what represents a description of my element A is a matrix. I could put a matrix there. So let me do first the E, that's the easiest. 1, 1, 1. Let's do 3 by 3, why not? Or we could do A and B. Another 3 by 3 matrix, and let me just see. And And then the last one, 0 and 0. There's not much point in me writing it down. I just want to show you that you can find these three matrices. One of them will play the role of the identity matrix. The identity is the simplest. And then the trick is to find two other matrices that when you multiply them with each other, you end up still staying in the same group. That's the only trick, let's see. And if I can do that, then I have found another representation of the Z3 group. So you can think on the Z3 in a very abstract way. You can think on Z3 as actually something that you want to use when you look for roots of a kind of equation in complex space. You can do Z3 as, for example, a representation of 3x3 matrices. So for example, you could be using this Z3 representation when you try to impose some kind of symmetry, Z3, into a sector for dark matter. So to use this kind of symmetry to maybe make dark matter stable and so on and so forth. But you see the same mathematical abstraction, different ways of representing the same group. Any questions? I hope I haven't lost you. Now, these discrete groups, finite groups with very few elements, and are very useful, but even more useful in physics, are groups with... where things are slightly more complicated. So often, what we want to do is to think of an element of the group let me call this little g not just as one element as a, b, or e, but I want to think on this element as actually depending on a parameter. So I don't have one element, I actually have a function, and that function is going to be an element of my group. So I want this alpha parameter to be something continuous. And maybe to make things easier, I can define that when alpha is equal to 0, my element precisely recovers to be just a unity. And then, as you can imagine, once I start doing these kind of things, I can make assumptions about this function and whether it's well-behaved, continuous, and so on, and I can start doing expansions around a small parameter.
If your g is the element of the function, does alpha have to be an element of your group? Can you have a function that is a group of a function that's not
a group? Let me make an example maybe to make it clear. So think now, to be more concrete, on this group as being rotations in 3D. So rotations along the x-axis, y-axis, and z-axis. You can always do that, right? So let's say this is my x-axis. I can do a rotation around it, or a rotation around the y, or a rotation about the z. Now, what are the elements of that group? Let me represent the matrix that is rotating along the x-axis as jx, jy, and jz. OK? And now I'm allowed to do a rotation of any angle I want. It can be very small, it can be 360, it can be anything. So let me call then this angle over here theta. So the limit of no angle, or angle equals 0, I'm doing no rotation. So just nothing, it's the matrix of diagonal. And I can always go and expand and build a large rotation by successive smaller rotations. So that's what I'm going to do. We are going to think about symmetries. In this case, it's possible symmetries and their rotations as actually something that has a parameter in it, and this parameter can be arbitrarily small. Those kind of groups, and then, of course, we will have to impose to these matrices exactly the same laws as everybody else to become a group. And once we do that, those groups are specific kinds of groups. They are called Lie groups. And those are extremely useful in particle physics. Lie groups are what we use to think about the forces of the standard model. The famous SU3 equals SU2 equals U1 is a Lie group. And a lot of our understanding of the properties we derive from these Lie groups come precisely from expanding around this parameter close to zero, and the behavior close to zero. Okay, so maybe that's a good moment to stop, actually, 10:30. And I'll see you later on. Don't get scared, we will get to more physics. It's not math, not only math, okay?